Hola, cage fighting connoisseurs. This is KidNativeBloodyElbow.com, joined once again by Conor Rubish and Zane Simon for the MMA vivisection of UFC 183, Anderson Silva versus Nick Diaz. But we're going to be talking about all the fights. So first, quick thoughts on the card overall. This is the end of a great month of UFC action. We had Jon Jones versus Daniel Cormier. We had Conor McGregor's coming out party as a star over Dennis Seaver. And we had something great since then. I can't even remember. What was it? What am I forgetting? That we just had. Didn't we just have a fight that was awesome?
Gustafsson Johnson, that whole
Gustafsson
card was good.
Johnson, yes, in Sweden, in Stockholm. Anthony Rumble Johnson emerges as a bona fide contender for Jon Jones' lightweight title. So lots of excitement, lots to process, and they're capping this off with the return of the greatest MMA fighter of all time, Anderson Silva, coming off a shattering, is it a tibia, I believe, snapped his tibia in two against Chris Weidman in December of 2013. Now he's coming back, and he's coming against MMA. Coming back against UFC's own prodigal son, Nick Diaz. Is he going to show up for the fights? He didn't show up for the open workouts. Maybe he missed his plane. Maybe he didn't. Who knows? Either way, very exciting fight and not a bad card, although Zane Simon might disagree. I'm at least a lot of familiar names on the pay-per-view card. Lots of interest. We got Calvin Gastelum fighting against Tyrone Woodley in the co-main event and a title eliminator for the welterweight division. We got Ally Aquina against Joe Lauzon in a fight that might allow Ally Aquina to finally emerge as the lightweight contender a lot of us thought he could be. Talos Leaders against Tim Boach in a fight that could have implications in the middleweight division. And Jordan Mayne against Thiago Alves in a fight that I think has implication for the welterweight division despite Alves' long absence. Plus, Miesha Tate and Sarah McMahon headlining the Fox Sports 1 prelims in a fight that has definite implications for the women's bantamweight division. So, but first, we got to talk about Andy Enns and Thiago Santos. Or should I let you guys talk about the main event? Do you have quick thoughts on the main event each? Like 1 minute?
I hear through the grapevine that Zane wasn't too hyped about this card. He was about to deny it before, but I'm just going to go ahead and steamroll him and say, Zane thinks this card sucks, and he's wrong. It's a good card.
True.
All right. So, Zane, you get 30 seconds to rebut.
Okay. I love
the 15
main
seconds.
Card. I hate the undercard. That's it.
I see. Okay. Well, that's fair enough. But now we get to talk about the fight. Everybody's humming about Andy Enns and Thiago Santos on the Fox Sports 1, not Fox Sports 1, on the Fight Pass prelims. It's a three-fight Pass prelims, and these guys are middleweights. Thiago Santos, the viewers told me who I was thinking of that was the blanket, and it's somebody Santos, but never
Bruno
mind.
Santos. Oh, Bruno Santos.
Bruno Santos, that's it, yes. Art blanket, which is a nomenclature I like. But Thiago Santos, not the arch blanket, more of like a half-assed brawler, pretty good grappler, standard Brazilian guy, and Andy Enns, unlike Eugene Robinson on the Care Don't Care preview, I'm not going to pretend I know who this guy is. Okay, Connor, quick thoughts. Make it quick. Quick prediction.
I would describe Thiago Santos as Wirley Alves light, in that he's very explosive and athletic and all the things that you say about guys who look muscle-bound and hit pretty hard. And he's got like a good guillotine, pretty MMA specific, but it's not like he really stands out in anything. I actually have pretty high hopes for Andy Enns. He's coming off two losses, but I think I still think he's a very solid fighter. He put in a good effort against Clint Hester in his debut. Didn't look so great last time out, but I think he's got potential. More so than Santos. So I'm picking Andy Enns.
All right, and Zane, your thoughts?
This is a really hard fight to get too excited about. I mean, and I feel bad because as an Alaska boy, I should be rooting for the Alaska boy in Andy Enns. But he's kind of a grappler who doesn't strike and doesn't wrestle, and that's a really tough way to be a fighter. And Thiago Santos, at the very least, he's a high-output striker. Like, he's really undersized for middleweight. That's been his big flaw. Is that he's probably a welterweight, or if he's not, he's stuck in this sort of netherworld between the two, kind of like, what's his name, the tough Brazil guy that people thought would be pretty good and just hasn't been, short guy.
Oh, keep talking, I'll come up with
Jason?
His name.
Jason? Is his yeah, nickname no, Jason? No.
But anyway, he reminds me a lot of, he could be one of those fighters kind of stuck between divisions, and I would pick Thiago Santos here. I feel like there's a lot better chance that he keeps enough of a high pace to outpoint Enns than the Enns is able to get him down and keep him down repeatedly.
You're thinking of Daniel Serafian.
Yep, Serafian.
Excellent, excellent. All right, and the odds makers, they like them some Thiago Santos. They've got him favored from minus 167 all the way up to minus 194. Andy Ince, the underdog, at plus 145 all the way up to plus 155, so not a huge range on that one. And that brings us to middleweights, Richardson Moray and Ildemar Alcantara, the lesser, although larger, of the Alcantara brothers. Zane, you can go first on this one.
All right, I'm a little more interested in this just because Alcantara's at least kind of been an up-and-down fighter, and I would like to see if Richardson, or Rick Monstro, as is much easier to call him, can show something more than he showed in his debut at heavyweight where, there's so many of these guys.
Just don't even try.
Yeah.
Just
he got knocked out in like 8 seconds by the guy who knocked out Feijão. Or not Feijão, but Poker Jacks recently.
Pokryak.
Yeah, Pokryak.
It's my gag to botch the guy's names, okay? So
well,
don't do that again.
He's Poker Jacks.
Stealing the spotlight once again, Zane. First the care, don't care.
Zane's
now
got
the
big plans. Yeah.
That's right. But anyway, you know, and so that's like that's reasonable that he got knocked out, but he's not that good. So I'm hoping that he could turn something around, show something new. He's pretty inexperienced for a guy who's already 30 and the middleweight. And Alcantara is going to give him a lot of chances to show something new. So it could be. I guess I'll pick Alcantara, but it's not like I don't know.
I see. So Connor, what do you have to say about this fight?
Yeah, I don't really have anything of value to add. I completely agree with Zane. I think that Alcantara is the safer bet. I think he's a very well-rounded fighter. He's not quite his brother, but he's a good fighter, good on the feet, good on the ground, relatively good wrestling, decent. I mean, you know, whereas Mojeda, it's just kind of a I can't count on you until you show me kind of thing with him. So,
fair enough. And the odds makers, do you have something else?
Is Rick Monstro a real nickname, or is that...
Yeah.
Along the lines of like the Ill Dill, Pretty Tony Pettis, and now Nikki Thrills, accidental nicknames.
No, Nikki Thrills is the nickname that we're going to make that stick to Nikita Krylov. He is only Nikki Thrills from now on.
Yeah, and Dillashaw, Ill Dill. I'm obsessed with Ill Dill. It's got to happen.
All right, well, let's get back to the odds makers on this fight. They've got Alcantara favored, although not by a huge margin, minus 170, all the way up to minus 196. Rick
Monstro.
Rick Monstro, or Richardson Moray, is the underdog at plus 145 all the way up to plus 160. Again, we're getting our odds from Best Fight Odds, and I need to take time out. Remember, give us a like on the video, subscribe to MMAnation.com, follow us on Twitter at BoxingBush, B-U-S-C-H, that's Connor, at These Days and Simon, that's Zane, at KidNate, that's me, and read us on BloodyElbow.com. And now we turn to Diego Brandão and Jimmy Hedda. Some dumbass said I didn't know who Diego Brandão was yesterday. If the care don't care, I'd have no idea what we were babbling about, but I do know who Diego Brandão is. The guy has disappointed and failed to break through to the top of the division in featherweight repeatedly, despite being... I can see where people will get him confused with Diego Nunes, who had a similar sort of career path, and he might be headed the same way, because Jimmy Hedda is no joke. Connor, you can go first on this one.
We've got a very interesting matchup here, because Diego Brandão physically seems to have all the tools he needs to be a top featherweight, and just seems to lack that mental edge to stay consistent and not go wild and gas himself out or break and lose his confidence. Both are probably caused by the same thing. And then in Jimmy Hedda, we've got a guy who appears to be very tough, and very resilient, and is very, very crafty, excellent at capitalizing on opportunities, especially on the ground and with his judo throws, but seems to kind of lack the physical strength to hang with other people around his size. And we've seen him get tossed around in a couple of fights now. He got absolutely ragdolled by Dennis Bermudez, and it's really hard to get that image out of your head when you're thinking of this fight. I like Brandão. Technically, as a technical analyst, I'm leaning towards Brandão because I think he's a phenomenal grappler, and I think he's got very solid striking and decent power. The thing is I think Jimmy Hedda is probably tough enough to withstand the first round Brandão assault, and after that it's really a complete toss-up. I'm going to go with Brandão just as being the more experienced and more athletic fighter, but I think Jimmy Hedda, if he is the underdog, I don't really know, would be a good bet here.
He is the underdog. And Zane, your thoughts on this fight?
This should be a fun fight. I'll admit that, like, I'm not really sold on the outcome of this fight as meaningful. Like, I don't see the guy who walks away from this fight being like, oh, if Jimmy Hettis puts on a great performance and stomps Brandow, I will be super impressed. If Brandow stomps Jimmy Hettis, I will not be, like, shocked. I'll be like, okay, yeah, now he's going to lose his next fight really badly.
This fight's kind of like a really lame version of Alves versus Meehan later in the night, where it's like derailed like prospect versus flower that never ever bloomed. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like that's a very good comparison, and I'm like, I have to pick Brandow just because of how badly Hettis got wrecked by Dennis Bermudez. I mean, like, that's just not something that happens to you if you're physically capable of competing at this level. You know, well,
Could have had a secret ACL tear he didn't tell anybody about. Come on.
He could have, yeah. Then, but, like, I can't bet on that. Like, you can't you can't bet on an injury that might have existed, maybe.
You can if you have a gambling addiction, Zane.
Yes, you can. My palms are sweaty already. But there's no sweet odds on this fight. Diego Brandow is favored, -167, 163 all the way up to -192. Jimmy Hettis is the dog, but not by a huge margin, +140 all the way up to +153. And that brings us to the Fox Sports 1 card, which starts off with Rafael Nadal and Tom Watson. This is a fight that has the fans buzzing. Just kidding. All right. Zane, you can go first on this one.
Okay, God. Like, you know, this is not a good fight. This is like the most middleweight fight that you could possibly make.
I was going to say the same exact thing.
Just like this.
Yes, that's exactly what I was going to say. It is the most middleweight. It's the kind of fight that the middleweight division is now desperately trying to pretend never used to happen.
Yeah.
Middleweight division's better now, but these middleweights are still hanging around.
Yeah, and it's just like the guys who have chronically disappointed are coming together to put on a fight that is almost certainly going to disappoint. And, like, neither of them are not, like, terrible fighters to watch. I actually like Tom Watson when he gets his game going and, like, gets his sort of offense working, even if it's almost all, like, right hands and right kicks and right knees.
And his pre-fight antics are usually good for a chuckle.
Yeah. And Nadal is exciting just because you know that he's, like, this far away from just totally screwing himself as hard as he can.
Nadal is not exciting, but I do get your point.
But it's like, you end up with two guys who, in general, are not, I don't know, they're not, like, Watson's really tough, he's not likely to get finished, and Nadal, and he doesn't have the power to necessarily finish anyone, so you have a guy who's not likely to get finished and not likely to finish anyone against somebody who's not consistent enough to win fights. And I guess I'll take Watson.
Brave call. And Connor, your thoughts?
I feel like I've seen this. How is it possible that this fight has never happened, and yet I'm sure I've seen it, perhaps in my nightmares, at least 100 times?
I think those who believe in parallel universes would tell you in thousands, like, of dimensions, this fight has already happened dozens of times.
Here's another one. Ed Herman and Chris Kamazi. They've never fought. Can you believe that?
Huh. We'll be talking about Ed Herman later on the card.
I'm going to go with Zane, except I think that Rafael Nadal has looked inconsistent, whereas Tom Watson has looked consistently terrible. Terrible, I would even go so far as to say. So I'm going to say that Tom Watson is going to lose by being considerably less able to do anything of note in any fight ever, whereas Rafael Nadal either gets knocked out or wins in boring fashion. So because if I look at Tom Watson's record, Nick Catone, did he, and the Sam Alvey fight, I mean, he's even the ones he's winning are terrible fights.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's going to be, like, super exciting. I just think Watson, like,
yeah, I don't have any confidence.
Way. Nadal, I mean, Nadal lost that fight to Chris Kamozi. Lost his last three straight.
That's true.
Question.
We can let that one go, though. Let's move on down the road and forget this fight is going to happen, because Saturday it's going to last long enough. All right, Rafael Nadal is favored, -169 all the way up to -193. Tom Watson is the underdog at +145 all the way up to +158. And that brings us to a fight that does have some juice, flyweights Ian McCall and John Lineker. Zane, yesterday you picked, I believe you picked Lineker, and he's the underdog. I picked McCall. Eugene also picked Lineker, so we'll let you go first.
All right, I'm still picking Lineker. I realize McCall's the smart pick. He's the more well-rounded and perhaps even more athletically talented fighter. I mean, McCall's a pretty supreme athlete when he gets everything going, clicking really fast, really, you know, explosive, great cardio, great energy. But I think Lineker's just the right style of fighter to break him. Just the right style of fighter to pull out all of his worst traits and beat him in the kind of fight that McCall, deep down, I think, if not loves, is easily drawn into.
A fight he can't resist.
Yeah. And I think that's Lineker's fight, so I gotta pick him here.
All right, and Connor, your thoughts?
We've analyzed this fight before on another Vivisection. It never came off, and my prediction has not changed since then. I'm also going with John Lineker. I agree that McCall's the smart pick, but the problem is that McCall is not a smart fighter. Or even when he is, he's not necessarily an emotionally sound fighter. And against opponents who are able to impose themselves, which there are a few flyweights on earth better at imposing their kind of fight than John Lineker, McCall gets sucked into that, whether it's because he loves the brawl or whether it's because he hates being beaten in an area of the game, so he just has to go ham and try to be better than you. You know, insecurity or confidence, it doesn't matter. We know by now that Ian McCall gets sucked into fights that are not smart for him. And in a knockdown, drag-out war with John Lineker, I don't really favor very many people's chances. So I like Lineker.
All right, and my palms are sweating already looking at these odds, hearing your verdicts, because the odds makers, they like Ian McCall. They've got him favored, pretty medium favored, I'd say, minus 220 all the way up to minus 243. Lineker is the underdog at plus 180 all the way up to plus 199. So if you can't resist the underdogs, this might be the one to bet the mortgage on, which we don't advise or recommend. All right, and that brings us to middleweights. Ed Herman, not Dave Herman's brother, against Derek Brunson. And Brunson is heavily favored in this one. So, Connor, you can go first.
This is a fight that's not guaranteed to be exciting. In fact, it probably won't be. But it is far more important than Natal Watson or Brandao Hedis. It has implications because it's at least getting Derek Brunson, you know, putting another streak under his belt. And I think Brunson has a potential to be a long-time top 10 middleweight with a couple more wins to build up his confidence. He's a very good fighter. He's excellent with his face shifting. He's a solid kickboxer, good wrestler, good submission skills. I mean, people forget just how damn close his fight with Yoel Romero was. It was very, very competitive, and Brunson was arguably winning the fight until gassing in the third round, and that's just because Romero has somehow, despite his frame, excellent cardio, or at least the ability to still throw bombs when he's dead tired. Mark Hunt cardio, we call that. So, it's obvious I'm picking Derek Brunson, right? Ed Herman is completely gone at this point. He really doesn't have anything to offer except being incredibly tough and his ability to walk forward seemingly for hours on end. So, I don't know. I can't even analyze Ed Herman's chances in this fight. It's all Derek Brunson.
All right, Zane, do you agree?
Yeah, if Ed Herman won this, it would be shocking. I think the big thing for him is that he's tough and he's strong. Ed Herman's a lot stronger than people think he is or expect him to be. But Brunson, I can't imagine him, you know, Brunson's faster, I would argue is probably even stronger and is just as tough and is technically more sound everywhere, and is a fighter that, yeah, is like just rising up into the prime of his career, should just be about to start clicking over on all cylinders. I think we started to see that against Lorenz Larkin, really. Like, that was the fight where it was really like Lorenz Larkin could do nothing to Derek Brunson in that fight. Even if it wasn't the prettiest fight, it was really just a wash. And I agree. Brunson has the ability to be a top 10 fighter for the next 3 years or 4 years, you know?
All right, and the odds makers agree. They've got Brunson pretty heavily favored, the biggest odds we've seen so far, minus 541 all the way up to minus 600. And Ed Herman is the underdog at plus 400 all the way up to plus 350 all the way up to plus 454. And that brings us to the headliner of the Fox Sports 1 portion of the fight, women's bantamweights Misha Tate and Sarah McMahon. McMahon pretty heavily favored. And I want to point out one thing. I think people, not that McMahon's not good, and I do think she probably will beat Miesha Tate, but I think people overvalue her Olympic wrestling credentials based on a misunderstanding of how advanced women's Olympic wrestling is. It's not women's Olympic judo, and it's definitely not men's Olympic wrestling. I think rising to the top of a field in any competition is a worthy event and reflects a lot about how competitive and controlled a person is, but I don't know that she's its enormous athletic talent. So I think Miesha Tate might have a better chance than some do. Having said that, Connor, I'll let you take up.
I've got to agree with you. I think we've seen kind of the limitations of McMahon's game in her past several fights. She didn't actually look bad against Rousey. Of course, she didn't have much time to show off because she got knocked out pretty quickly with that body shot, but she looked relatively controlled. Her striking was the area that really seemed to be her big weakness, but then in her last fight with Lauren Murphy, frankly, I thought she lost that fight. It was a bout in which she was content to just lay on top of Murphy while just getting constantly peppered with punches and elbows and up kicks and various things. And Murphy was going for submissions and attacking her with strikes. And McMahon was just doing nothing. And so I think we're kind of starting to see that McMahon, you know, whether or not she is a really skilled wrestler, is it at the very least struggling to apply those skills to MMA in a very meaningful way. She can take you down, and she's obviously very strong and powerful, but her striking is limited. Her grappling is just basically the takedown, and then, like, she didn't even have any guard passing versus Murphy. It was pretty limited stuff. She had a little, but, you know, not very competitive. All of that aside, I don't really see Miesha Tate having a path to victory here. She's not a very good striker. She loses focus really, really easily. We've seen that in both of her fights with Ronda Rousey. If it turns into a slugfest, she will slug not with the best of them, with the worst of them. She will throw all technique out the window and just square her feet and stick her chin in the air and just pump both pans out. No power, not really much technique. You know, when she sticks with her wrestling, she can be good, but then, as we saw with Ronda Rousey in their rematch, she'll stick to her wrestling even when it's not working. So she doesn't really have any ability to adapt. And I think she's going to need to adapt at least one or two times to Sarah McMahon's strength and her ability to impose her will. So I'm hoping to see an improvement in McMahon's jiu-jitsu, her top game grappling, her guard passing, and I really think that's going to be very important here because Miesha Tate's only real avenue to success is probably her guard game, which is decent. And I'm also hoping to see some better boxing from McMahon, a little more use of her left hand, a little less of the, you know, the 1997 version of what a wrestle boxer is, a little more of the 2010 and after version.
All right. Is there any thoughts on this fight?
Yeah, there may be a serious comparison to be made between Sarah McMahon and Kevin Randleman in there.
Yeah. Rudimentary wrestle boxer.
Yeah.
Without the freakish athleticism of Randleman. But she's a very good athlete, but she's not leaping over the cage.
Well, yeah, but for women's bantamweight, I mean, there's Ronda Rousey, there's Sarah McMahon, and then
there's everybody else.
Yeah, like, you know, I would actually argue that Holly Holm and Lauren Murphy are probably the next best athletic talents in that division from just a pure physical strength and speed ability kind of thing. And it's, you know, that, like, Sarah McMahon, Lauren Murphy, that was a tough fight for McMahon, but I would actually argue that Lauren Murphy's a much tougher fight than Miesha Tate. Tate has rarely ever impressed me. She squeaked by Rin Nakai. Squeaked by.
But she's got over a million Facebook friends, Zane. Come on.
Yeah, I thought she lost to Liz Carmouche. And
none of whom are allowed to sell her autograph.
Yeah, none of whom are allowed to sell her autograph. So, Miesha Tate rarely impresses, and even in victory, and I don't see her, like, she just doesn't fight consistently at all. She'll be striking okay, and then she'll get so predictable that she'll just start getting hit and hit and hit, and then she'll try to wrestle, and her wrestling game just goes into this really ugly lockdown sort of top control nothing wrestling game, and it's just not good.
So you're picking McMahon.
I'm picking McMahon. I don't think it'll be a close fight.
throughout her career, I think Tate's like ace up the sleeve has been her jiu-jitsu, which is better than better than advertised. And we saw how much less it was than Ronda Rousey's. You know, she like Tate barely managed to beat what was it, her last Strikeforce fight?
I'm sorry.
She's retired now. She does commentary for Invicta. Kedzie. She barely managed. She got kickboxed to hell by Julie Kedzie, knocked down, hit with head kicks all over the place, and barely squeaked out an armbar at the end. And that's just kind of the story of Tate's career. Like, she used to win consistently, but never really looked great, and now she doesn't even win consistently. So.
All right, so it sounds like, if you believe our panel, in which case you might want to check your head, Sarah McMahon, even at these odds, might be a good bet. She's favored minus 199 all the way up to minus 220. Misha Tate is an underdog at plus 159 all the way up to plus 195. And that brings us to the main card, which starts out with welterweights Jordan Mayn and Thiago Alves. Hopefully, Jordan Mayn's dad is going to be minding his P's and Q's in the hotel. That was his dad that had the issues in Oklahoma. Yes. So
he assaulted the housekeeper.
Allegedly. Didn't he pay a fine or something? Anyway, I can't remember.
In the eyes of the court, I'm pretty sure he did it. He was arrested, and I believe he paid a fine. And
all right.
Was there also a warrant? There was a warrant out for his arrest.
But none of that means anything until there's a conviction or a plea. And so I do believe you're right about the plea, so in which case, forget the alleged. So anyway, hopefully that won't distract Jordan, because those Vegas hotels can be cesspits, I'm told. So Thiago Alves, once upon a time, a title contender, fought Georges St-Pierre. Not the man he used to be. A ton of injuries in this kid's career. Is this the fight that proves Jordan Mayn is for real? Zane, you go first.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Thiago Alves, I think he's become a more technical and more studied version of himself. He's from the technical aspect, he's a better fighter than he used to be, but he's also a less physically dominant fighter than he used to be. I mean, you look at, the fight he had with Seth Baczynski, where he came back after 2 years, like, that was a good performance. But, one fight later, Baczynski's getting knocked out by Alan Joban. And Joban's not bad, but...
He's not what Thiago Alves used to be.
Yeah. He's not, like, Thiago Alves is maybe not quite the same wrecking machine he used to be. And at this point, I think Jordan Mean, like, he's young, but he's been around long enough that he should be hitting his prime and the peak years of his career. And he looks really fast, he's technically really sharp, and I just see him being able to beat Alves to the punch and perhaps knock him out even.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with Zane on that. I have trouble making this pick because I really did think Thiago Alves looked good against Seth Baczynski. It was a very entertaining fight in which Alves showed excellent defense and excellent ability to close the distance on a much longer man, and was one of the few times in his career that Baczynski used his reach really well. He used his kicks, he used his long limbs, and Alves still outstruck him pretty easily. Yeah. He got a little marked up, but you expect that when you're constantly crossing the threshold of a much larger man's arms and legs. But, if we look through Jordan Mian's career, especially taking into account what Zane just said about him likely peaking athletically right now, he really only does lose to wrecking machines. Jordan Mian would have lost... Sorry,
turn off your phones.
I'm so sorry. Jordan Mian would have lost to the earlier version of Thiago Alves, probably. But, losing to Matt Brown in a fight that was incredibly competitive, that's not really a condemnation of Mian's abilities. And then getting blanketed by Tyron Woodley in Strikeforce, nothing wrong with that either. And everything else has mostly been stoppage wins, or at least very impressive kickboxing performances. So I think that while Alves has technically improved, it's really been an attempt to make up for his athletic deficiencies, whereas Mian is coming into his athletic prime, and I think he's actually getting better as a kickboxer along the way. So Mian speaking, Alves is obviously not. Should still be a close fight, but I got to go with Mian.
All right, and the oddsmakers tend to agree. They've got the odds close, but they've got me in favored. Minus 129 all the way up to minus 160. Thiago Alves is the underdog, which is unusual for him. Plus 108 all the way up to plus 130. And that brings us to a middleweight fight with implications. Talis Lidis versus Tim Boetsch. Bad luck, Tim Boetsch. Seems to be on a downswing. Talis Lidis has really turned things around, is continuing, or has the opportunity to continue his middleweight run. Connor, you go first on this one.
Why can't Tim Boetsch fight the Tom Watsons and Chris Kamazis of the world? Why?
In the hot, I bet he gets paid a little bit more than those guys do, and so he's got to earn that paycheck.
He gets paid because he's exciting, and it's not really fun or exciting to watch him get pasted by much better elite middleweights. You know what I mean?
Sadly, he's given some elite or near elite guys some tough fights. I mean, he's the guy got the decision over Lombard, and so you know he's paying the price for having overperformed, I think.
Yeah, I think that's an apt point. It's impossible to pick Tim Boetsch against Talis Lidis. Lidis has improved so much since his first UFC run, really turned into a dangerous, dangerous striker. If not completely polished, he's more than enough as a southpaw to get the job done because he gives so many fighters difficulties. He's got much longer arms than Tim Boetsch, and he's got power. I mean, we saw that recently against Francis Carmont. He's got knockout power in those hands, and he's still as good on the ground as he ever was, and that was always his calling card back in the day. So, I mean, Boetsch has, like, good infighting and some weird, awkward kickboxing, but just has seemed kind of lost for a way to win the fight in his past three or four fights. He seemed
Austin Phillippe stole his soul, I think.
I think so, too.
The viciousness.
He broke him in that fight, and since then, Boetsch has looked like he really doesn't know what he's doing out there. He's just kind of going until something lucky or something terrible happens to him. And in this fight, I'm going to go with the latter as being the more likely option.
Yeah, because Boetsch, if you look at his record recently, the Tavares TKO aside, which is a great fight, I thought he lost to CB Dolloway, and that would have been four losses in a row. So this is a guy who's 2-for-3 in his last five fights, and he's going in against somebody on the upswing. So Zane, your thoughts?
Well, yeah, I mean, if you wanted to really go into it, he was losing to Tavares, he could have lost to Dolloway, he could have lost to Lombard, and he was losing to Okami. So you're going all the way back to Nick Ring to the last time that he, like, put on a dominant performance. And that's rough. I mean, and the weird thing is that Boetsch, I mean, you know, he may be 34, but he's only, like, this should be, like, the best years of his career should be right now. We should be seeing prime Tim Boetsch right here. And we're not really. We're seeing a guy who can still land a big strike when it comes around and when he gets his opportunity. But, you know, Lidis seems to be one of those rare fighters who has just slowly and steadily gotten much, much better with age. And with cage time, and now suddenly is just looking like a fearsome fighter. And I can't see, I mean, if Francis Carmont gave Talis Lidis zero trouble, which he did, Lidis just ran him over, I can't see Boetsch having any chance.
And I really think as a result of his schedule, people are underrating Francis Carmont. He's still a very imposing and solid fighter, and he'll probably show that now that he's back on the regional circuit. Mm-hmm. And just because Lidis was his third loss in a row, I mean, it was still very, very impressive for Lidis to beat him in the way that he
Absolutely
did.
Absolutely, it was. I mean, and I'm no Francis Carmont fan, but he's somebody you've got to respect his abilities and his grit. He's just boring to watch, and I was glad to see him get washed out. Lidis is somebody that either he got a great improvement in his striking coaching, or I bet that for a long time he's been really good at striking in the gym, and it took him a while to get really comfortable and confident to bring it to the cage. But something happened. He ate his Wheaties. We don't know, but this guy is for real, and I look forward to seeing him move up the ranks and fight some tougher competition. Should be a good showcase fight for him against Boetsch. But Boetsch is a dangerous cornered animal. I mean, ask Yushin Okami, ask Brad Tavares. This is not a guy that you take lightly, even unless he's got both hands broken and he's blinded like against Costa Philippou. This guy is always dangerous to the last minute in the cage. Nevertheless, Lidis is heavily favored, -430 all the way up to -500. Tim Boetsch is the dog at +325 all the way up to +369. You degenerates and loyalists to Maine might want to throw down everything you've got on Tim Boetsch. That will really make this fight exciting. All right. And bring it to Ally Aquinta versus Joe Lauzon, lightweights. Ally Aquinta, this could be his last chance. We've said it's Al Iaquinta's last chance many times on the show to break through. Joe Lozano, definitive lightweight gatekeeper, the king of the Fight Night Bonus. Always a gritty, tough opponent, but Iaquinta should win. And if he beats Joe Lozano, it's one last chance to get on the contender track. I believe it's your turn to go first, Zane.
All right, I don't know about last chance. Iaquinta's still got enough miles left to, like, hit that. Lozano's really, along with Pearson, was really his first shot at, like, can you get over into the top 25% of the division? Lozano is sort of the next, now you've done that, we're going to keep matching you up with that level of fighter. So I think he could maintain there for a couple of years, even if he loses this fight, and then finally get that chance to break into the top 10. But this would be the first chance to fast track into the top 15. And it should happen. I don't think that Lozon's at the point in his career where he should be beating somebody like Iaquinta, but that said, he looked pretty good against Michael Chiesa. Chiesa can't strike nearly as well as Iaquinta can, but in the grappling exchanges where I expected Chiesa to also do well, Chiesa did not. Lozano was able to really handle him there. So if Lozano can close Iaquinta down a lot and grapple with him, he may be able to really handle Iaquinta really well in those exchanges.
And Iaquinta is the kind of guy who makes mistakes at key moments, and Lozano's the kind of guy who can capitalize.
He has. He's looked a lot better with that lately. I mean, his performance against Ross Pearson was singularly dominant. And Ross Pearson is, especially in the way he beat him, boxing in the pocket like that, that's no joke, to really just put it on him like that. So I have faith that things are clicking for Iaquinta, so I'm going to pick him here, but depending on the odds, I don't know, Lozano could be somebody worth a submission win bet.
And Connor, your thoughts?
Yeah, I something stood out to me after Iaquinta beat Ross Pearson, which was in his post-fight interview. He said that if you keep putting me on a big stage, I'm going to step up to the level of my competition. That he really shines when all the bright lights are on him and he's not fighting in front of maybe, 500 people, but in front of a packed stadium on the main card against a tough fighter. And it was quite easily the best and most complete Al Iaquinta performance we've ever seen. And so, I don't know if that maybe only stands out to me because his stablemate, Chris Weidman, is the same way, where the bigger the stage, the higher the stakes, the better Weidman seems to do. But I believe Iaquinta, and I think that if they continue to give him big fights, we're going to continue to see him not breaking down or having mental lapses. I think it really brings out his focus. And, while Lozano was really competitive with Chiesa in the striking and more than competitive on the ground, Chiesa also lit Lozano up with plenty of shots. He had no trouble hitting Lozano, and Lozano's been consistently hittable his entire career. In fact, plenty of his fights have been him getting dropped and then submitting the person once it ends up on the ground, or just walking through shots until the fight's over. The Michael Johnson fight was one of the most consistently bad performances I've ever seen from someone on the feet, and I think even though
I felt like I knew more about slipping the jab than Lozano after that fight. It was
exactly
incredible. Frustrating to watch that.
Lozano's striking strategy is just incredibly rudimentary, and Iaquinta's is pretty polished. I have a lot of faith in the game planning and coaching abilities of Ray Longo and Matt Serra, and not so much in the abilities of whatever camp Joe Lozano is running for himself. So, I like Iaquinta here, and I think he may get a knockout. I'm not sure how much Joe Lozano's chin is going to last, but I kind of am feeling a late knockout, third round knockout.
I cannot argue with that. And I think your points about training with the middleweight champ Chris Weidman and being coached by Serra Longo, who are one of the hottest coaching teams in MMA right now, there's just something about absorbing that aura of winnerdom that I think Iaquinta is soaking it up. And he is favored at minus 180 all the way up to minus 215. Joe Lozano is the underdog at plus 155 all the way up to plus 175. And I hope he doesn't get beat too badly, because Lozano, I think any UFC fan with any experience knows that Joe Lozano is an ace guy. He's put on so many great performances, mad respect, and I really don't want to see him take unnecessary brain trauma in this bout. And that brings us to Kelvin Gastelum against Tyrone Woodley. This is Kelvin Gastelum's big day. Ultimate Fighter winner. This guy, he upset Uriah Hall. Is that right? Was it Uriah Hall?
Yep.
And since then has continued to improve with every fight. He's no Miles Jury. I think he's much more aggressive. I think he's ready for the big time. Tyrone Woodley, Here's a guy who's been floating around near the top of the division for a while, hasn't quite got the big break. He really needs this win, but I don't know. I'm feeling a lot of Kelvin Gastelum here. I'm excited for this fight. Connor, you can go first.
This is a dangerous bout. Tyron Woodley, the tricky thing about predicting Tyron Woodley's fights is that there are two distinctly different Tyron Woodleys that consistently show up. It's either baffled wrestler Tyron Woodley, who, if he can't get his hands around your hips and take you down, seems like he's just floating around at range with no clear idea of what to do. Or it's badass boxer Tyron Woodley, who knocked out Josh Koscheck and had a really back-and-forth fight with Nate Marquardt and knocked out Dong Hyun Kim and outkicked Carlos Condit. You know, it really is, it's tough to say. Woodley comes from a really good camp. He trains a lot at Evolve MMA, and so his striking skills, I think, are consistently going to keep improving as he trains.
So he's no longer with the Black Zillions? Like, there was the whole bit about him and Hector Lombard being teammates, and he didn't want to fight his pal, and Hector Lombard was all... That was ATT. You're right. So is he no longer with ATT?
No, I think he's still at ATT. I think he just splits time at Evolve. Same as Rafael Dos Anjos is Cordero all the way, but he also trains at Evolve to polish his Muay Thai skills.
I see.
Over there in Singapore, they have legit experienced Thai instructors teaching their fighters how to kickbox. So, you know, that's a really good thing for Tyron Woodley. ATT and Evolve right there is a great combo of coaching camps. And I think we've seen some of that. The thing is, we've also seen him struggle with guys who can pressure him, guys who can keep him out of his comfort zone. It's exactly what happened against Rory McDonald. It happened against Jake Shields, and Shields is not – it wasn't the kind of pressure you normally see. But just by slowing the pace of the fight down and trying to hold on to Tyron Woodley, you know, he just kind of stopped – trying, like he wasn't having fun, so he stopped trying. And with Nate Marquardt, the same thing ultimately happened, even though that fight was very competitive at first. He got pushed against the cage, found himself stuck there, and he got knocked out in brutal fashion. And so I can easily see Kelvin Gastelum doing that. The X factor
brutal fashion is a good description of the way Kelvin Gastelum has been fighting lately.
He's a brutal fighter. I mean, he finishes guys and he's mean about it. He either knocks you down and jumps into submission, or he just knocks you straight out. Or, you know, he's had a couple. The Nicholas Musoke fight, for example, wasn't super impressive, but it was still one of those kind of bumps in the road, learning opportunity fights for what is still a very young and inexperienced fighter. He's 23. He's only had 10 fights. So, you know, he's doing amazing for his current level of competition. He's the
yeah, and I think he has no sense of mortality or vulnerability, and it's just all Kelvin's going to win, Kelvin's going to win, Kelvin's going to win, and Kelvin's going to hurt you doing it. So it's very exciting to watch this kid.
And I think that's the X factor here, is I think that Gastelum is so confident in the pocket that he tends to get himself into trouble spots when he doesn't need to. We saw that against Rick Story when he was just going wild, swinging, got his feet all out of position, and got knocked down. And he tends to bounce around on his toes. He doesn't have the fact that he's so inexperienced means that sometimes he doesn't seem to realize he's just kind of hopping around in your effective range. Sometimes he doesn't seem to realize not to get greedy with his combinations and keep defense in mind, that you're actually not close to being finished and he should stop swinging. And
if the wrong Woodley shows up, that could make for a very bad combination for
Woodley.
That makes this a very exciting fight.
Woodley's a devastating puncher, so I have to pick Gastelum. He's got all the momentum on his side, but Woodley might be a promising underdog bet here.
All right, and Zane, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think one of the big things that kind of surprises me a lot is that Woodley's really only been fighting for, like, 2 years longer than Kelvin Gastelum. On a career path, Gastelum's not that much further behind him in terms of experience and total, you know, time in the gym, even though they're almost a decade apart in age.
And also, Woodley has a big edge and big fight experience.
Yeah, but I don't give that a lot of...
You've never faced the bright lights, my young friend. You've never faced the bright lights.
Well, Gastelum's now been in the UFC, what, for 5 fights? I don't think...
Half of his career.
Yeah, at some point, I don't think that... I think that no longer becomes an issue.
I think you're probably right.
There's this... potential for me, it's all about this idea of, like, is Gastelum gonna keep breaking the curve? Is he gonna keep exceeding the expectations of his career? And it does feel like he is. I think a big question: where has he usually trained outside of when he's not at Yuma?
He's Alliance, isn't he? Is he Alliance?
Is it Alliance? That does raise some questions to me, because I mean, the more he's at Alliance, it does seem like the better fighter he is. He certainly can't keep training at Yuma, and I don't think he will. I think he tried that against Musoke, and it was a god-awful performance on his part, even in a fight he won. So, you know, I think he's back at Alliance against Ellenberger, and he just wrecked Ellenberger. So
he trained with Johnny Hendricks early on.
Yeah, he trained with Hendricks early on, but I think he's at Alliance mostly now. And I don't love that for his technical progression, but they do seem to at least be good at keeping him fit and keeping his aggression high. And so, like, I have a question there. Like, it's hard for me, you know, his level of aggression and his level of athleticism make it, I think, give him an advantage as the kind of fighter that can really trouble Woodley. But the potential for him not to be progressing technically in the right ways do give me some pause. I'm picking Gastelum, but it's not a comfortable pick. It's not the kind of pick where, like, I would be like, oh yeah, this is a hot fight to bet on, because there's a clear favorite. I think there's every chance that Woodley stays, you know, intelligent and, you know,
and aggressive.
Gastelum to make mistakes and just lights him up.
Yeah, I think if you're Calvin Gastelum, his mom, his coaches, any of his fans, you should be very scared about this fight. Because if you're not scared of Tyron Woodley, you really shouldn't be in the cage. This guy's a scary, bad dude, and it's a big test for Calvin Gastelum. And I'm picking Gastelum, too, but the more I think about it, the scarier Tyron Woodley gets. So Gastelum is favored, but not by enormous margin, minus 110 all the way up to minus 125. Woodley is the dog, but plus 100 all the way up to plus 120. And that brings us to the main event, a fight some people say has no business being made. Anderson Silva, the greatest middleweight of all time, against Nick Diaz, a prodigal son of the welterweight division. And so a lot of X factors here. Anderson Silva snapped his leg. He's aging. He's slow. He lost twice in a row against Chris Weidman. Nick Diaz has been basically on the shelf, holding out for big fights and big money for a long time. Stylistically, you'd think Anderson Silva is just made to destroy Nick Diaz. However, he's not really like that enormous a middleweight. Nick Diaz is a pretty big welterweight. The reach isn't going to be that enormous an advantage for Silva. So I think it's a more competitive fight, but I think anybody sane has got to go with Anderson Silva. Connor, am I right?
Yeah, I think it's a much more competitive fight.
You can
fight.
Stop there now and say, Zane, am I right?
Sure.
Joe's over. Okay, thanks, everybody. Now just go ahead. And one more thing before you go. Your cats and your wolf statues have been freaking me out the whole time. Every other shot, the cat is there but not moving. And I'm like, does he have two wolf statues? No, that's a cat. Wait, does he have a cat? No, that's just a wolf statue. Anyway, go ahead. Anderson Silva, Nick Diaz.
Well, I lost my focus now, Nate.
I know. I do that to make you look bad and me look good.
It's very effective. Very effective. I agree. It's a very competitive fight. I think it's likely to be a lot more competitive than people expect. I also think a lot of people are going to be surprised at how similar in size Nick Diaz and Anderson Silva are at the weigh-ins. People are saying, like, oh, Nick always has a huge reach advantage and such. Well, that's because Nick's a pretty damn big welterweight. He, you know, just the fact that he fought at lightweight back in the day, which was really 160, he's not that person anymore, and he's filled out a lot. If you watch his fight with GSP again, you can see that he's considerably larger than the welterweight champion was at that time.
Yeah, I'll never forget how he towered over Frank Shamrock. I mean, this is a pretty big guy for a welterweight fighter.
He's pretty big, and Anderson, people say that he's a light heavyweight size and everything, and while he is, there's not a ton of difference between the frames of guys at light heavyweight and middleweight to begin with, and he's been smaller than most of the light heavyweights he's fought. He was smaller than Bonner, he was smaller than Griffin, and he was smaller, I think, even than James Irvin. And so he's a little chubby for a middleweight sometimes. He's 40, so he's allowed to be chubby. But I don't really think he's a giant middleweight. He's long, but he's not giant. And so, you know, I think that the size discrepancy is not going to be as big a factor in this fight. I don't want to go off the rails too much. I think it's going to be competitive. I think Nick Diaz has the potential to walk Anderson Silva down And the thing is Anderson's...
Really? Nick, I can't cut off the cage to save my life. He's going to walk down Anderson lateral movement, Silva?
Here's the thing. Anderson has moved laterally less and less with each of his recent fights. A little bit of a change with the Chris Weidman bouts where he was doing a lot of dancing around and stuff like that. But let's look at the Bonner fight. Let's look at the first Weidman fight. How much time does he spend these days with his back to the cage, baiting the person to come at him? Anderson used to bait in positions that were secretly advantageous to himself. He would lean his head forward and drop his hands, but that way he could predict that you're going to throw a punch at his head, which you could then easily pull back from and counter. Standing with your feet parallel against the cage is sheer bravado, or it's the only way a guy who's slowing down as he reaches his 40s can possibly get somebody to close distance with him anymore. Anderson can't be young forever. You know, we're fight fans, fighting is exceptional. And we expect the exceptional, but we've already gotten our fair share of the exceptional with Anderson. We can't just keep expecting him to fight at a level that doesn't look like a 40-year-old's level. That's Nick Diaz's chance. Also, the fact that Anderson's such an emotional fighter, he's such a weird, enigmatic guy that I think I'm not sure that he'll be able to resist the temptation to answer Nick Diaz's constant beckoning and requests for a war. You know, Nick Diaz is going to do to him what he did to Chris Weidman, and I don't know that Anderson's going to be able to resist that. So, you know.
But isn't Anderson's accuracy and power, I mean, doesn't that just trump Diaz? Isn't a war just fine? War with Nick Diaz just fine for Anderson?
I think so. And the thing is I found this out, and this is quite startling. Anderson Silva has 17 knockdowns in the UFC and 14 knockouts, which means if he knocks you down, there's an 82% chance the fight is over. He's going to finish you. And I think he's actually knocked out every single person that he has ever knocked down. It's just that Okami and Griffin both got up once before getting finished. So if Anderson Silva hurts you, the fight's over. That's really been his track record so far in the UFC. Nick Diaz has been known to be dropped in the past and come back.
The Paul Daly fight just jumps into my head.
Right, exactly. But see, Anderson is just as powerful as Paul Daly, probably more so, and he's not going to
He's not swinging from the hips, yeah.
Exactly. He's a very, very calculated, methodical finisher. He will keep his posture, he'll stand over you, and he'll drop laser-accurate punches on your chin until the ref has to stop it or you go out. So I don't know that I can really bank on Diaz's durability as much as we have in past fights because of how good Anderson is on following up on any success on the feet. It's so tough to predict where Anderson is. Nick Diaz is reliable, but that also makes him predictable. So if Anderson is anything like his old self, he should be able to pull this out, but I do expect him to have trouble with Nick early. I'm thinking a fourth or fifth round TKO for Anderson. I don't think he'll put Diaz out entirely, but he's going to keep hitting him when he eventually does drop him, and the ref's going to have to save Diaz from himself.
All right, and Zane, your thoughts?
Yeah, this is... I think that there's a big question of, you know, will Anderson Silva still be physically fit? Like, that's, you know, or just have a chin? Like, is he going to get hit by a big flurry and get hurt immediately? And
is he going to go out there and throw a leg kick and snap his leg again?
No, I don't think that's really something I would worry about. That's not how leg injuries tend to work. But the big thing, like, you know, I'm actually happy that Diaz took a couple of years off. Like, I think that was really smart for him. The kid's only 31.
It was much smarter, I think, than fighting a whole wave of wrestle boxers and just getting ground down with lay and pray. And...
yeah. Like, Diaz is only 31. He's been fighting for 12 years. Like, he's either, you know, at worst, he should be done. Like, nobody fights well for longer than that, really, at all.
Yeah, ask Joe Stevenson. I mean, this is a guy who started at 16, and people thought he would have more to his career, and he just fell off a table in his late 20s.
Yeah, so, you know, by all means, Nick Diaz should probably be at the point in his career where things are not, you know, working that well for him either. And if you look at his fight against GSP, he had absolutely nothing for GSP.
Like, I disagree with that.
When he got to the ground and when he got to, like, grappling, he had, in the point where the fight was standing, he did decently. But when it was on the ground and when it came to positions of, like, competing physically with GSP, like, for control, it was basically just wait for an opportunity to get up.
Sure. I think we can pin that down to Nick's proven inability to make adjustments mid-fight. He's going to do the Nick Diaz thing or whatever special edition they've made this time around all night long. But, I mean, is he going to wind up on the bottom with Anderson? And if he does, I mean, Diaz is a better grappler than Anderson. I know that's probably controversial, but Anderson has, like, a trapping, holding, hopefully we get stood up or I'll survive the round guard. That's usually what he does these days.
Or he'll triangle Chael Sonnen in the late rounds.
Yeah, right. But
What I'm saying is that he couldn't, like, I'm not saying that he can't, you know, he may not be technically a better grappler than Anderson. I'm saying that if it gets to the point where if it's about his ability to do something dynamic, he may not be that dynamic.
Sure. He's not a very dynamic fighter. He may be
even less dynamic than he ever was, is what I'm saying.
It's possible.
That's quite possible.
We've got an interesting combination here of, like, Diaz, we know exactly what Diaz is going to do. The really big question is how Anderson's going to react.
Yeah. And I think there's a question of, does Diaz do what he used to do as well as he used to do it? That's a question for me. I don't necessarily believe that he does, but I also don't know now that he's been sitting out for a while. Like I say, I think that's actually a smart decision.
Yeah, and he's been training with Artem Levin and Joe Schilling. I mean, Artem Levin in particular, what an amazing sparring partner to have for Anderson Silva's hands down, please try to hit me in the chin so I can counter you style. Like, nobody does that better than Levin right now. So that's, you know, it sounds like he's been making some smart choices in preparation for the fight, giving his body a chance to recover. We know he's in great shape. The thing is people talk about the Carlos Condit fight and the GSP fight, and they make it sound like Nick Diaz. People use the word exposed, which I hate, because no matter how easy you think it seems to just not allow Diaz to trap you into the cage, it's worked against some very, very good fighters. And a lot of Nick's opponents have started their fights with him, disciplined, determined to stick to the game plan, not to fall into his tactics, and he knocks a lot of them out or he submits them. You know, they most of them can't survive, and most of them, their minds just can't hold up to it. The reality of being in a fight is a very stressful situation, and Nick Diaz thrives on being able to manipulate that. So I think Anderson's a pretty emotional guy. I think he's capable of being frustrated. I think we saw that against Chris Weidman. He's capable of losing concentration. He's very patient.
Like Damian Maya. I mean, this is a guy who went, you know, can just take goofing around with a guy who presents no threat and parlay that into losing a late round.
Yes, and I also think that Nick Diaz is deceptively powerful with his hands. I think a lot of people overlook the fact that he's got a pretty heavy right hand, and just because.
And have we ever seen anybody really work Anderson Silva's body ever?
That's another excellent point. You know, punch a hole in his chest. We don't know Nick Diaz is going to try and do that. So, I don't think he'll be able to corner Anderson early. But the possibility of him getting closer and closer to that goal as the fight progresses is pretty likely.
Maybe. Yeah, it's one of those things where you kind of I feel like I'm making a legacy pick for Anderson Silva, and
both these guys are a legacy pick. They've been out of the cage for so long, we have no idea what they're like in 2015.
Well, yeah, and I mean, Nick Diaz, it's sort of like I can see the potential paths to victory, and I can see both guys having potential paths to victory, and it'll really just be who shows up looking like what in the cage, and that's really hard to predict. And I think Anderson Silva has more tools to win. I think he's shown more tools to win, but you know, if things aren't clicking for him, then Diaz is, you know, classically been exactly the kind of fighter where everything has to be clicking to beat him.
Yeah, yeah, because he's a dangerous guy. He's got a long record of big wins as an underdog. This guy's undaunted by anybody, afraid of nothing. The Nate Diaz's last performance against Rafael Dos Anjos spooked me, though, because those two brothers have run so close throughout their careers, with Nick always consistently outshining his little brother, but the way Nate came in flat with nothing for RDA really freaked me out. I mean, yeah. that just was like a guy not even trying, and it was very atypical of Nate. And I don't see Nick doing that, but it still spooks me. I could see either one of these guys, though, showing up and not being the guy we expect. Your point about Anderson Silva leg kicks, leg breaks don't work that way. Your shin bone should heal stronger. They might have put some titanium reinforcement in there. But is he going to have the confidence to throw those leg kicks?
I don't care what anybody says. Your leg will be stronger, but there's no way your mentality is ever the same. I think if Nick Diaz successfully checks one kick, it'll spook Anderson. I don't see how it can avoid it. He's got to be the toughest man on earth to not think, holy shit, what if my leg breaks again when one kick gets checked, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And even if it heals stronger at that point, that's a long bone, you know? I mean,
fortunately for him, though, Nick Diaz checking even one kick is like...
It would be a miraculous day, yes.
According to Joe Schilling, they've been training it extensively.
Parts of me really wonder how much of Nick Diaz in the cage is just so hardwired that, like, no camp is going to change that.
That's what I wanted to ask, Connor. You were talking about his famous inability to adjust during fight. When have we seen him adjust from fight to fight?
Never. I mean, that's not true.
KJ Nunes fight.
That's not true. Like, for example, he came in specifically intending to knee bar GSP because he knew he'd get stuck in turtle. So he came with that specific thing in mind. And when he fought BJ Penn, he came in and fought most of that fight in orthodox so that he and BJ could kind of get in close and he wouldn't be so much on the end of BJ's jab and stuck outside in an open stance fight. And he came with like a head forward stance in that fight too to try to grapple with BJ. He does come in with like game plans, but he's more or less Nick Diaz each time out with maybe one new trick added, and he does not adjust from fight to fight. He did the same thing to Carlos Condit for their entire fight. He did the same thing to GSP for their entire fight.
You mean within a fight?
Within the fight. If he plans to do it, he's going to do it for 5 rounds or until one of you stops.
Yeah, yeah. The Condit thing was really frustrating as a Nick Diaz fan. I'm a Carlos Condit fan too, but I thought that was just brilliant tactics on Condit's part, brilliant strategy by Greg Jackson. And Diaz, you're just screaming at him, cut off, he's moving out to your right every time, you know? Yeah. Throw a right hook as he rolls out. Do something.
The real problem is not that Nick can't move laterally, because he can. Like, he can cut off the cage and sidestep with you, but he attacks linearly. Every single time he attacks, he's stepping straight forward. And that's what Vitor Belfort did, and that's why he was so easily evaded by Anderson. Anderson's very good at waiting for that moment of attack and then sneaking out the side, which is why Chris Weidman was the first guy to knock him out. It's because Chris Weidman... Like, it was as simple as taking a diagonal step when he threw his hook, and it caught Anderson in a position from which he thought he was safe. And so Diaz can't do that. But Diaz also brings a different kind of confidence and frustrating style than Weidman did, so it may make up for it. I don't know, but, I mean, I picked Anderson to win. I think he's going to stop Nick, but it's tough to call.
Absolutely, and the odds makers, they like Anderson Silva. They've got him favored at -440 all the way up to -550. Nick Diaz, the underdog, at +325, +300 all the way up to +400. And man, if you're a Nick Diaz fan and you're on the couch of the bong, sweeten that up with a life-changing gamble. Like, bet everything, your college fund, I'm kidding. Don't do that. That's terrible gambling. Oh my God, what a terrible, terrible advice. But boy, do my palms get sweaty at the thought of winning a long shot bet like beating Nick Diaz, beating Anderson Silva. Anyway, any final thoughts on the card? You have like 2 seconds.
Connor. I've got some betting picks. I think that John Lineker at plus, if you can get him at +199, I think that's a hell of a bet. I would put not a large amount of money on that, but I'd put a unit on that. I honestly think that Sarah McMahon at -199 is a pretty solid favorite bet. I do not see Misha Tate having any shot against her. I like Jordan Meehan at -129. I think he's got a very clear path to victory in that fight. And if you're going to go with an underdog bet, it's kind of your call. You've got more value on Nick Diaz in a riskier fight, or you've got okay value on Joe Lauzon as an underdog, because we all know Lauzon's so good at snatching up opportunities. So I'd make one like half-unit bet on Lauzon at +175, or a half-unit bet on Diaz.
But how do you make your palms sweaty doing that, betting for the favorites? And
that's a good point. You should drop $100,000 on Nick Diaz.
Whether you have it or not, absolutely. This is our finance. No, we are not licensed financial advisors, and do not gamble. I would say,
just as an addendum to that, and maybe I'm totally off base here, but if I were going to bet on Nick Diaz or Joe Lauzon, I would maybe make it a prop bet of... like Joe Lauzon by submission or Nick Diaz by knockout, because their paths to victory are almost certainly going to be through that avenue. Like,
honestly, you may also find a Nick Diaz prop bet on Nick Diaz goes the distance as an underdog, which that's pretty viable too.
Yep. Good advice. Yeah. Any final words?
I don't know that I would necessarily pick Nick Diaz to beat Anderson on points, But if he's going to win that fight, it's almost going to certainly be because he knocks Anderson out. And if Joe Lozon wins his fight against Ali Iaquinta, I think it's almost certainly because he's going to submit him.
And then definitely balance that out with the Meehan and the McMahon bets, because you need to hedge him there, because Nick Diaz winning or doing anything well is a risky bet.
Yeah.
Indeed. But, you know, get that thrill, boys. Get that thrill. All right, that's enough funny games. So we'll be back with the sixth round after the fight. Zane and I, Connor, will you be joining us for the sixth round?
I may. I think I'm definitely going to be seeing the fight, so I may. It really depends on where I get the opportunity to see it.
Okay, well, cross your fingers, guys. And Zane, I'll look forward to joining you Saturday night. And then Eugene will have Knuckle Up, and then rinse and repeat. I can't remember what's happening next in the UFC. It's not as good as what's been happening, but there are some big fights in February, and we'll be covering them with all the usual care, don't cares, Knuckle Ups, vivisections, etc., etc. So thanks for joining me, guys. Remember, follow us on Twitter. Connor is at BoxingBush, B-U-S-C-H. Zane is at TheZaneSimon. I'm Kid Nate. Read us on BloodyElbow.com. Subscribe to MMAnation.com on YouTube. Never miss a minute of the magic. You might never know when Zane's going to turn the show off midstream again. If only people could have seen Eugene's face. He was laughing and laughing. Then you disappeared smartly. And then he realized the show had actually been turned off. And he really was pissed there. Eugene's a busy guy. And he goofs around a lot. But this is a guy who's got a professional career. He's got bands. He trains jiu-jitsu and competes at jiu-jitsu. And he's very professional with his time. And he fucked with his time.
There's a reason that the moment I hit stop, I was just like, hey, I'm just going to let you guys deal with this and I'll be out of here later.
That was a good call. That was a good call. Anyway, I wish that moment when Eugene had really realized it had been caught on tape. But anyway. We'll be back next time. Adios, MMA aficionados. This is Kid Nate. We'll see you next time.